I'm here in sub-county Dublin County Buildings, and I'm talking to Stanley Lang, a now retired councillor from here. But Stanley, going back to the beginning, you're a Cavan man.
I am, yeah. I was born in a little place called Ballyconnell. My father was a miller there, and he died when I was very young. And I left Ballyconnell with my mother to live in Red Hills for a short period, and she died while there. And I then moved on to Mullingar and spent some years with my auntie and uncle in Mullingar.
Yeah. Your father was a miller?
He was a miller, that's right, yeah.
And working in, can you remember the
company? He was,
company?
Well, the company he worked with was a firm called Ballyconnell Milling Company, which is still operating. It doesn't operate mills as such anymore. They've branched out, it's owned now by cousins of mine called the Ennises, and they've branched out into a factory in Virginia. But they have been my father's premises, has been there for generations.
Yes, indeed.
So,
yeah.
As I say, he moved out and died very young.
And were the Langs always involved in milling? Can you go back to your grandfather?
Yes, I think my father and grandfather, that generation, were involved in this mill in Ballyconnell, which was probably the only bit of industry they had for many years until Sean Quinn came along. Mm. And of course, he's developed the area now and has become a very good industrial base now for both him and many others.
What's your first back memory of growing up there?
Well, my memory, of course, is that my father unfortunately left Ballyconnell when I was literally 3 or 4 and went out to New Zealand to further ambition. He wanted to see how things were done out there, I think, and he wasn't long there until he was involved in a bus strike, and he offered to drive a bus out there, and apparently was badly beaten up and died subsequently from that involvement.
He never
returned, and that was the end of the.
You never really knew your dad.
No, so. I never knew.
And he decided to do this.
Did he
go with other people? Or did he go himself? Or
well, he went himself.
Just himself.
Yes.
Yeah. To New Zealand.
To New Zealand. Yeah, yeah. And well, he went with a brother of mine who's a few years older, and that was part of the. There's probably other stories behind that which I don't know,
yeah.
But he
took his son out. Brother.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but he was only then. He would have been only 8 or 9, that type of thing. You know.
Yeah.
But that was the end. Then my mother and myself then went to live with an auntie of mine in Red Hills, which is not far away. It's a lovely little village. And we stayed there until my mother was, she died in her 40s. And
she died a young woman too.
She died of severe anemia, which was a difficult thing to cure in those days. There's no cure. And she deteriorated and died in Cavan Hospital. And then I spent some years in Mullingar with an auntie and uncle of mine, who was a Presbyterian minister there in Mullingar. And I spent some time there, and he taught us until we were teenagers, and subsequently left us, went to private school, you know.
So you were educated by
my uncle, who was a clergyman.
Yes, indeed.
And it was one of those things where, he apparently the department must have accepted that he was fully qualified to, and he taught all his children. Yeah, and I was at a funeral the other day with my first cousin, which was taught by him, and that was one of the. The discussion was that how in actual fact he taught all his children at home.
Yeah.
until they were teenagers, of course.
Did that stand to you? Memory now of your education? And
well, I first of all, you see, I went to the National School in Red Hills, where I had a very good grounding, excellent National School, absolutely. And I well remember going to National School in Pony and Trapper, where they had a kind of a covered in caravan in those days. And that's how we went. We picked up the school in the horse-drawn van and brought home. But it was an excellent school. Nixon's going to say we went from there to Mullingar, where my uncle educated me until I was a senior and teenager. And
what did you, when you finished school then, you told me you went into, joined a company, sold paints.
My first involvement in industry was I was an employee of Edges of Fairview, a famous landmark in North County Dublin, and there was a paint and hardware shop there, and I joined Edges of Fairview and subsequently joined Brooks Thomas and Williams Lassen Paint, always in the paint industry, and I finished up in Berger Paints as a company technical sales representative as an industry division.
Yes, indeed, and you must talk me through that, because that must have been a fantastic time, because you were born in 1930, so you were now, we're now talking about the 50s.
That's right. So, as I say, I was involved in the paint industry all my life. In my early days, I was purely a salesperson in Williams Lassen Paint and became manager of it, indeed. And then I went on to Brooks Thomas and was employed there in the paint department there, and subsequently applied for a job in Berger Paints as a sales representative, and I called on the retail trade in County Dublin.
But you were in the industrial side of it,
I was calling on the retail trade first of all, in Dublin, and then we set up what we called the industrial division, and I was appointed technical sales rep for the company and travelled to 26 counties.
Did you indeed?
Travelled to 26 counties. But however, as I say, it had there weren't many calls, because in those days industry was only beginning to expand in the various counties, but I enjoyed that, because I called on most interesting time that, because I called on all the major companies such as Fiat and Ford's and the big
Fiat
big
and Ford
Fiat and Ford's in the motor assembly plants.
Yes.
And Fiat had a plant in South County Dublin in Ballyfermot. Or never been North County Dublin, no, South. And we were the main supplier of their, you know, every car has a fair amount of paint in it. And we sold thousands of gallons of industrial finishes to the Fiat company in Ballyfermot. We also supplied most of Ford's. They had a huge assembly plant in Cork.
Yes.
And we were one of the main suppliers there. We also supplied, there were several other small manufacturers. But as well as that, I called on computer firms and tubular furniture manufacturers and that type of thing, you know. So it's a great experience. Great experience calling on all these companies.
Well, staying in the 1950s now, the economy wasn't great.
Oh, no.
People were immigrating.
That's right.
Now, but when you were moving around the country, were there pockets which were doing better than other places, or were we all in the same boat?
No, I think you're quite right. There were certain sections doing reasonably well. In those days, my period in the country, Galway Industrial Estate was starting up type of thing and getting involved, and the various small industrial estates were coming around, and that was really the start of establishing a firm industrial base in the country generally. But yes, it had its difficulty things. I mean, that was one of the, then later on, of course, as you know, Ford's and Fiat closed down because it wasn't economical to assemble four or five cars a day or whatever it might be. And so they all closed down, and that was that.
But can you tell me the pockets that were doing well now? You mentioned Galway were doing well.
Galway
were good.
Galway were doing nicely. Well. Yeah, doing
who nicely. Else were doing good?
Well, now? Waterford. Waterford were doing reasonably well.
And then, what was going on down in Waterford too?
Well, they had various engineering plants, light assembly plants, engineering plants. One of the famous plants I supplied materials to was a company who had these precision weighing scales, and they weighed somewhat as far as the atomic dust and all this type of thing, you know, very specialized weighing scales. And that was that. And of course, County Dublin was doing reasonably well as well. I mean, they were just developing their industrial base. And as I said, I'd say Galway, Waterford and County Dublin were Well, I mean, Killarney, not that they had the big factory of Lee Bears of Killarney, were establishing a well-known factory down there. But apart from that, Cork, of course, had its base, and of course, Forge were the main industry in Cork in those days.
And so the paint business was up and down. Is when the car factories closed down, then it kind of
we had difficulty then.
Slump then,
well, there was, but then there were other industries coming in to make up for that deficit. We had parts of the computer industry coming online, and then we had a number of tubular manufacturers in the furniture business, and they were expanding all the time. So it was a big drop. Forge and Fiat closing down, and who was the firm up in Santry? Hunters, the Chrysler company. They went.
Oh, where were you situated?
Well, our factory was in Dublin. And
what parts of Dublin were you?
First of all, we were in James Street. In James Street, with a factory there, and that closed down. We merged several times, and eventually the factory, which is still in the base now, in Coolock in North County Dublin. Yeah.
And the company name again?
Berger Paints.
Berger. So you had the agency from the English company, did you?
That's right. Well, yeah. Well, that would be right, because Berger's in England were major industrial finishes. And so my technical director, he thought it was a wonderful idea to take on their expertise. And so I was employed as technical sales rep, and then with a technical director who's in charge of manufacturing. And between the two of us, we built up quite an industrial base in the finishes.
How long did it last?
Well, when you say how long it lasts, well, the big companies only lasted just about 15 or 20 years, I suppose, that type of thing.
But how long did you last in the business?
How long did I last in the business? Well, I was there on 38 years. I retired in the late, where am I now? I was 38 years with Berger's.
Okay, so you went in there in the early 50s.
I was 38 years.
You saw three decades with them.
That's right,
The 50s, 60s and 70s.
That's right, yeah.
And that's when the country really was beginning to take off.
Yeah. That's right, industrial development. The Sean Lamass period.
That's right. And growing up, or at least the business growing up in the city here, did you like your work? Was it exciting, or was it just a day-to-day job? You know, did you take it seriously?
Oh, I did, yeah. Oh, I really enjoyed calling in on the... I mean, it was a great experience traveling the country and meeting various people, and every factory of calling was different. I was traveling to a factory, one minute it might be a motor assembly plant, and the next minute I'd be calling a company who's manufacturing tubular chairs, or it might be various bits and pieces for the tourist industry. I had a wide range of that, which made it all the more interesting, because if you recall, as I was in the early days, I was calling on purely shops, which is very day-to-day sort of, and very uninteresting sort of selling, going to a shop and waiting around for half an hour and picking up a small order, whereas in the industrial business, much bigger business and much more specialized, because once you were in, providing you had the right technique and the right expertise, you're in for some time, you know. So it was a most interesting. I enjoyed my time with Berger and the technical sales end of it, really did.
And did you advance your position there, or were you always?
I did advance from being a sales rep for the retail trade in Dublin, and it was a considerable promotion for me to be involved in the industrial end of it, where I was technical sales rep for the whole country, you know. So it was quite an expanding and a responsible job, because if anything went wrong with a paint on assembly plant, I was called in and to try and resolve the matter, you know. So it was very interesting.
Did anything ever go wrong with paint? Did you ever have problems? Yeah.
Oh, plenty of problems, absolutely. Because you were, well, in many ways you were depending upon the manpower. In those days, the plants were manually operated. You know, as distinct from automated, I mean, automated and robots were only beginning to take place as I was leaving. But I had, when you say that never go wrong, even it did, I was supplying a certain company and very good quality paint, and kept complaining that there were spots in the paint. And I called the manager brought me down to the painter, and we had a long chat with the painter, and I said, show me exactly where these spots are. So he showed me, and he couldn't repeat the spots. And when I'd be gone another few days, I'd be called back again, they're back again. And I said, look at it. I said, this is very strange, because I said, I've taken a sample of the paint. The batch that I supplied was very good. And I said, are you cleaning your face with anything? And, oh, no, sir. I said, oh, okay. Well, I said, okay, let me see your spray. And the fellow sprayed away. And when we finished, he lifted up a cloth, which had silicone barrier cream in it. And it was contaminating the paint. And of course, in a short time, the spots reappeared, and we found out silicone came out, all spot the paints, and then the cloth he was using was on his face, and he was handling silicone, really.
Right, and that was
the cause of the
reacting
problem.
With the paint.
Reacting to paint.
What? I know now that paints have changed, but in the early days, there was a lot of lead in the paint.
But that was replaced in my latter day, or my early day. And that was a lead-based paint was in the ordinary retail trade, but in the industrial finishes, there was very little lead paint. It was changed. That particular formulation was changed. As a matter of fact, when I was supplying, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I was supplying the cotton industry, baby's cots, and of course you couldn't have any lead in it, so you had to be very careful. That's one of the plants I was supplying, and we had to be completely lead free, you know.
But what about the painters using the paints that had a lot of lead content in them? When you were there in the beginning.
Well, I'm sure the manufacturers would be pretty well covered. I mean, I was supplying paint to a specification.
Yes.
You know, so it had to be lead free. Yeah.
It's just quite interesting, you know, the advancement of paint. You know, when I suppose we came all the way from water wash and lime.
That's right.
Paint.
Oh. Indeed.
Homemade paint.
A long way. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What's in the manufacturing of paint? What is the makeup of paint?
The makeup of it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, what is the recipe that gives you paint?
It has changed radically over the years from a lead-based paint to titanium and other raw materials. And as I say, it's changing all the time, because nowadays you have emulsion paints coming, washable paints coming in, which weren't washable years ago. And I was responsible for talking about paints. I think that I can tell you one interesting story, because I was the first to launch what we call thixotropic or gelled paint on the market in Dublin. And we were ready to launch our Magico's range, which was a famous range in the retail trade. And we were ready to launch our paint. I don't know if it was Friday or Saturday, but it was a week. And I was going down Capel Street one day, and I heard from the grapevine that a competitor of mine were about to launch their gel paint. So I rang up, I was really young from those days, I rang up my sales manager, and I said, bad news for you. He said, what's the news? He says, so I said, well, I'm afraid we're just beaten by a few days. I said, there's another manufacturer. Oh, he says, look, he says, we have ours ready to go anyhow. So within hours, I was in T&C Martin's window in Dublin, which is a major, major retail trade in Dalier Street in Dublin. And I was in the window there putting on my gel paint, and people crowding around the windows wanting to see what this is all about. But we were the first manufacturer to launch what we call jelly paint. In other words, it hadn't got to be thinned. You should simply put your brush in, and this was in supplied in gelled form, and still in the marketplace today. Not as gelled as it used to be, I don't think.
Yes, but that was the first time
we were the first to launch gelled paint in Ireland.
Yeah, and there you were in the window shop.
Yeah, in the window shop.
Displaying how it was done.
But see, it was the main asset, the main benefit it had, that there was one coat that you could put on this over anything, which was a bit... at times that was a bit
dicey
because didn't many because yeah, if you want to put white over or deep red or bright red, it's not going to. But it was a marvelous product, magical, it was a great range.
Yes, indeed.
Great.
Yeah. So the paint industry at the time was people were getting a little bit better off, and they were painting their houses all
Absolutely.
Different colors.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was the different trends, the different fashions in color of paint? You must have seen that change too.
Oh yes.
From the browns,
from
and
the greens
grays
and the browns. And My father-in-law was a great man for painting, and always did a position kitchen every year. He'd ask me now for a grass green. Don't forget me, bring me home a bit of grass green before you go on your holidays. So green, you're quite right, greens and browns. But during my days, colour schemes, there was a very specialised trade there, but these colour consultants were springing up all over the place, and they were producing colour schemes. And they had what we call feature walls. The feature wall would be a nice deep beige or whatever it might be, and the main inners would be a nice cream or white. So the trends changed dramatically, and the days of the greens and the browns died out. As you can see now, you see very little brown paint. I think there's, on my particular roof, one brown house in it, which is conspicuous by its by its presence. Yeah,
but it was so drab, wasn't it?
Like, oh, it was.
You could imagine.
That's right.
That it
well, color has a big bearing upon a person's. Much is that they're not their attitude, I'm trying to get the right word, but on their outlook, because I had the opportunity or the responsibility of calling on St. Tita's Hospital and various hospitals with mental problems, and you had to be extremely colour, very careful exactly what colour you supplied. A large member, we supplied a colour scheme to St. Tita's, and as you're quite right, they had these very old drab greens and browns and very, very bad colours, and we repainted the whole place in a nice white and cream and beige, and you wouldn't have, and it had a dramatic effect upon the outlook of the patients. Dramatic, you're quite, it has a very big paint colours are have a very big bearing on the psychic, yeah.
And did you see that change?
Oh, I did.
What was the decade? What was the time? Was it in
the '60s? That would have been. That would have been. 60s, 70s, 80s. That yet have been 60s.
Would it? Yes, indeed. Yeah. So the tendency for brighter colours, light.
That's right, more light, yes. Brighten up it, because the browns and things, they were very, very depressing, as you say, and needed to be changed. But it certainly had a big impact upon the hospitals and places that they changed the colour schemes.
There was also a change in fashion in furniture, and you mentioned Schubler furniture. Mm. So you were supplying paint to the Tubular factory.
That's right. Yeah.
The paint would go where now? On
the sealed tube. We have in this office. You can see square tubing there. That's all painted in a factory, and we had office furniture, the retail, the domestic furniture, Tubular furniture, stacking chairs. All that was just coming into the Irish market, where you have a hall with a few hundred dozen chairs, a few hundred chairs, and that's painted with it, what we call stoving enamel, sprayed on wet, and goes through your oven and stove.
What was the start of all that? I mean, why did people change to Tubular instead of timber?
Well, the Tubular idea was good because it was stackable. Whereas with an ordinary wooden chair, you couldn't stack 6 or 8 wooden. Whereas with a Tubular chair, you can stack maybe 8 or 10 or a dozen chairs, and they're stacked in a corner and they're assembled each day or brought around. You know what I mean?
Do you remember the introduction of Tubular furniture?
Well, that was it was. See, the great thing about it is there that talking in about the paint industry is this. You could paint a chair very quickly by spraying it, whereas hand painting to office for that was dying out, you know, and the spraying gradually was more technical, and we had a system what we call electrostatic spray, and you simply went down one side of your tube with your spray gun, and it wrapped round the complete barrel. So in other words, instead of having to move your gun straight spraying it all you did was go around one side of your Tubular, and you had all sides covered. And then that eventually changed, which was, I was just finishing up with, to technology, which you had a stationary electric, instead of manually operated, it was manually operated from, it was technically set up to spray all sides on the stationery business, yeah.
Who were the first people to bring it in?
To bring in...
Tubular into Ireland?
To produce tubular furniture.
Yes.
There were a number of them. See, they all started, a lot of them were in very small premises, but producing thousands of chairs every week, very small premises.
And who were your best customers in the
tubular manufacturing?
Yeah. At the beginning,
a fellow up in Castlebenny, small little factory, producing thousands of tubular furniture every week, both for the industrial market and for the domestic market.
Was there a tradition in Castleblaney for furniture anyway?
That's right, there was, yeah. Good. Yeah, they were moving. I mean, they were big into... And Navan, of course, was a big furniture manufacturer there. And they were mainly in the wooden end of it. But gradually, they nearly all set up a section within the factory to deal with what we call the tubular demand.
And I suppose when you look at the cars at the time, and when you look at the shop fronts, you in particular would take notice of the paint, the colour.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, that's, my wife often says to me, I'd be walking down the street with her and I'd say to her, do you see that van there? And I'd say, she'd, yes, what's it? And I'd say, see the colour of paint in that van, and do you know what? I supply something that paints. So there was a huge, you're quite right. I mean, I literally learned my business by observing exactly what was the current trends in the marketplace, coming in from various industrial bases within Europe. And I'd go back to some of the tubular pattern and say to you, by the way, I saw such and such a tubular furniture the other day, and they said, yeah, we're thinking of producing a line in that particular line. So the industrial base was the most interesting base to be a rep in.
What about the people themselves, your customers that you were dealing with?
Yeah. Great. I had great stories, great time supplying, because my job was to... Not alone, I wasn't dealing with the people in the office administration. Well, I would, they would deal. But most of my calls on the people was to go down and to talk to the various spray painters and see that everything was working, or if they had any problems with the paint. And if there were any problems, as you say, I was dealing with those. But there were great characters. I remember when Fiat's plant was being talked about to close down, and I was in the factory one day, and I was chatting to the boys, and I said, listen, lads, what about... Can you not change your mind? So this is going to be a great loss to the economy up here in Ballyferm. It's probably one of the only big manufacturers up here. And I said, would you not consider in trying to increase your output here and see what we can do? And they told me, no polite language. Look, we're going to do very well out of this, and we're closing up. So they did close up, and I'm sure they got a good financial deal, but I think within a short while I met some of them, and they were sorry they closed the factory, I think, some of them.
Yes, indeed. Because
were
you trying to...
But I was trying to encourage them to increase their output, because I think they're probably only turning out probably 6 or 8 cars a day, and that was very small business, you know, whereas the factories in England would have been turning out... That have been turned out probably, I don't know, depending on the fact, anything from a 50 to a few hundred cars a day, you know. So it was a matter of production basis. So, but it changed, and that was a big, very difficult period of change when the motor assembly plants closed down.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult.
Yes, indeed. It did cause ripples.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And at that time, you know, there wasn't too much. When people were redundant and left go, there wasn't too much of a chance of getting another.
You're quite
job.
Right. Very little, because there was the engineering industry was only developing. There was very little prospects really for alternative employment. Very, very little, and they had to go and retrain. But then, of course, in my latter days, the assembly plants the office furniture people, the office people, and that type of business was increasing all the time, because of the factories setting up and the demand for office furniture was increased. But you're quite right, it was very difficult for all the staff to get alternative employment. Very difficult.
In the 39 years that you were in the paint on a graphic scale, What were the highs and the lows in paint?
Well, the high, I said the highs is the one I mentioned to you about the launch of gel paint that transformed.
Was in what year now?
That, I'm not quite sure. What year would that have been? That have been early 60s, would have been right about early 60s, I would say. And that was a big change in the retail paint market, because you can imagine somebody going into a paint shop and saying, I want a tin of white paint, and, well, do you want liquid paint or gel paint or half gelled or full gelled, or what do you want to do? So it opened up a completely new... And then, as I say, the highlight of my business career was calling on the motor assembly plants and the huge industry, that how it developed in a small country like this was absolutely terrific, you know. But then we had our lows then with that downturn in industrial development. And we were, during our talk there, I forgot to mention, of course, there was another dramatic change in the industrial paint business, was a change from wet to powder.
Oh, yes.
And that powder was a huge change. Now, most of the shops now would be, I'd say, probably 80-90% of the paint finishes are what we call powder applied. Instead of applying your paint in wet finish, you apply it by powder.
Yes.
And instead of applying your paint in cans, they're simply sent in 8 or 10 or 20 kilo boxes of powder. And they produce a range of shades in powder, and we produce shades specially made for the tube blenders. But that has been a dramatic change. That's a complete new technology that's brought into this, come into the paint industry, from wet to dry.
Now, when you were introducing that to the shops, did you meet with
I met with a lot of skepticism, because people were saying, God, Dan, you couldn't be playing a powder paint. What are you doing? And once they got into the technique, because it was, even though it would seem it was a lot dusty and all that, but the extraction and the system, the technical system was set up. And the main thing about the powder is this, that you had very little wastage. You had a recovery system with the powder. Mm-hmm. You saved anything that was overspread, you saved it, and eventually it was reused again with your virgin powder. So there was a great economies to be got from the powder industry. And then it was very easy applied. It was applied rather like the wet paint on tubular, what we call electrostatically applied. It was also applied electrostatically, but a different, of course, different technology backup. But it was a marvellous change, and most of the factories during my last 10 or 12, 15 years with Berger would have gone over to powder, and that was not manufactured in Ireland. That had to be brought in from the UK and Belgium and other countries. So that was a major change in the technical paint industry side.
And did you find that that there was a tendency in shops to specialise in paint? You know, when you were going around in the early 50s. You had the market store, you had the shop selling everything, including paint.
Yeah.
Did you see a change in that?
What the major paint shops were doing, they were setting up what we call a trade center within their shop, within their center, and you'd have a section of the shop would be dealing purely with what we call the trade, the painters and decorators, and then you'd have another end for dealing purely with the retail, and you'd have a man or two or several, depending upon the size of your shop, several people there dealing purely with the trade who were specialist in paint applications. So yes, you're quite right. There was a lot of specialization going on.
And were you encouraging that? Or
I mean, after all, you had to encourage the big business. That's where the large volume was being sold to the decorators and developers or whoever they might be, you know. You had the painters coming in, you know, looking for 10 and 20 and 50 gallons of paint, whereas it took a long time to make that up from the lady coming in looking for a pint of paint. So the trade was a very valuable, even though it was very cut-price and very, you know, there was a lot of competition there, but it was very valuable part of the retail trade, you know, the trade.
What about the painters themselves? Did you ever, you know, meet the lads on the ground and the fellas paint, you know, with the ladders and the...
Did
painters generally follow in families? You know, that if you had a father, the son would paint and
so
on.
You get a certain amount of that. You get a certain amount of that. But sad to say, I don't think that, whereas in my early days, there was apprenticeships going, they had the painter's apprenticeship and they learned a lot. And nowadays there is a tendency, I understand from what I hear, for painters to be going in to be the builder would employ a couple of them and say, and they say, yeah, I'm a painter, or they might be a painter for an hour, but they might never have an apprenticeship. And I think that's what's lacking in the trade today. It's not the professionalism or the training that there used to be. I think they're shortcutting.
But it was there, wasn't it?
Oh, it was there. Oh, yes.
And the apprentice to be
a painter or a plumber. Oh, yes. In the trade, despite the apprenticeship was essential, you know. You had to do a 3 or 4 or 5 years apprenticeship, which, you know, was tough going, very small salary and all that type of thing. But that has changed now. And as I say, I'm not up to date. I've left the paint industry now for some years.
And did you find it hard leaving that? I mean, when it came to the end of 30, 9 years doing that, why did you leave?
I come to the end of my retirement. I was due to retire about that period. But during the last 5, 8 years or so in Burgess, I was actually a counsellor. So during the last years that I was in Burgess, I actually had come through my first election. And I had to come to some agreement with my company that obviously I had to attend meetings during the day in the county council. In those days, that was the Dublin County Council, which I was elected to. And so I had to come to some agreement with Burgess that I would take half days off to attend a meeting and forego some of my annual leave. And so I was a part-time counsellor for the first 6 or 7 years type of thing. And then as I left Burgess, then I became a full-time counsellor, which much more, much better from everybody's point of view.
You know. And did you find yourself, when you went into the council, you had to be elected now.
That's right.
So yeah.
I was elected in 1979.
Oh, so
that was my first. I actually contested a general election in 1977 when I knew very little about it. But
did you go into politics?
Why did I go into politics? Well, very simply, there was nobody in my family. No, we hadn't got, shall we say, a history of political involvement. But you know, in those days, and not quite so much now, but we used to go around the various houses collecting for Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or whoever it might be. And a lady across the road from me called to my door and called her. I was very young in those days with one or two children. And she said, would you like to give me something towards Fine Gael? I said, I would if I had it. So I said, things are very lean. I said, but however, I said, there's a couple of shillings and that's about all I have. And so she came back to me and she said, Sandy, would you like to join the branch?
Just like that.
I was involved in the Residents Association in those days, and I was involved in various other clubs and that type of thing. And she would like to join the branch. Well, I said I would.
But there was no Fine Gael background.
I had no Fine Gael background whatsoever. None. And we went down to a branch meeting and in Temple Oak, and very nice people, but all fairly old. I was only a boy in comparison to them. And within a year, I was elected to chairmanship of the branch. And so, like all young people, you're raring to go and you wanted to see change. And so after first meeting or two, I said to them, well, now I said, we're going to have a plan for the year. I'm going to contact various people, have speakers in to do talk about various. And some, I could hear the rumbling saying, who the hell is this young fellow coming to trying to take over? So it was an interesting time of change, and I enjoyed it, I must say, in those early days. And then, as I say, I went to a convention to select candidates for a general election in 1977. And in those days, Dublin, of course, was a different landmark and different boundaries. And the late John Kelly, He was moving from one constituency to another, and there was a vacancy. And I went to the convention not with any intention whatsoever. And one lady friend of mine, Sir, because I proposed Stanley Lang that he should run in the general election. And that was 1977, and I ran in that. And I got over 2,000 votes. And my wife and myself, we walked the streets with very little help, and got 2,000 votes. Then I ran in 1979 for the local authority, and I've been running. I've never had that. I topped the poll in 4 out of 5 elections.
And why do you think you did that? I mean, why?
Well, I always loved support, and this might seem a bit bumptious, but I always loved serving people and helping people. I'm one of those individuals, in actual fact, to put it bluntly to you, I intended to go into the ministry. And this is another story, when I'm afraid I intended to go into, in my early days as a teenager, I was very keen on becoming a minister in Presbyterian Church. And I was always keen to serve people and to help people. And so I found that the local authorities, a councillor, his main job really is helping people, because most of the calls I get with people on the phone say, I have a problem, or indeed, I have a problem, it's confidential, could you have a chat with me? Or indeed, I have a problem with a footpath outside, or a wall, or whatever it is, or a community centre. And so I feel I've enjoyed the County Council extremely, because the main thing about it is helping, talking to people, and helping people to get through their lives.
And well, that's interesting. No, becoming a minister.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe that hemmed from your upbringing and probably your so. Uncle, you know.
Probably so. Yes.
Who
probably,
was
well,
it
had certain bread, but even so, even prior to that, I felt that Christ was a very important part of my life.
Yeah.
Very right from when I was a boy, I was committed to Christ. And
did it matter to you that living in Temple Oak, and that's where your constituency
that's
is?
That's quite right, yeah.
No,
my ward is Terenure Rathfarnham.
It is, and I'd say 90% of the people that you would have knocked on their doors would have been from the, say, the Catholic
denomination.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you find was there a kind of a barrier, or a line, or anything? Did people ask?
I very, very rarely, would have talked religion or otherwise. And if they did, most people understood my belief and my ethos. And most people nowadays, and in those days, are Christian.
Oh, yeah.
That's different. I felt there was no...
But did you find that? Did you find that people... Probably, did they know you? Did they know that you were from a Protestant background?
They did. Most people my age would know Stanley Lang, that's the Protestant fellow that lives up in...
Was it? And made no difference as well?
Made the slightest difference. In fact, you can take it that most of my votes, 99% of my votes, are from Roman Catholics.
Well, so if you top the poll,
I enjoyed... I went so far as to join the Samaritans for some years. As well as that... I'm trying to think of the group which I joined with my local parish priest, which was a prayer meeting, a group which we had prayers and we had great times together. We'd have set up a great community in the area. So you've got to be able to understand each other and to help one another, and that's what life is all about.
So from 1979 onwards, when you were elected, what was it like? You were watching Temple Oak and the surrounding area develop fairly rapidly.
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of new people coming in.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah. What were you doing as a councillor for them?
What was I doing for them? Well, I was elected originally for the Terenure Rathfarnham, for the Terenure ward. And you're quite right, it was only in its infancy then, because my road, Templeville Road, I was the fifth or sixth house in Templeville Road. There were no houses in the surrounding, no houses in Cypress, no house in Waynesford. These are all surrounding, nothing. And during that early 5-10 years, it was a rapid development of housing and huge changes. And then there was a need there for, of course, for community centres and for community facilities, need for halls, need for parks, need for sports centres. And as I say, that was the big demand in those days for community centres and for facilities for young people. And I was involved in still am involved in a project. We acquired an old house from St Michael's House in Temple Oak called Temple Oak House. It has historical values, preservation or and I would presently developing that for the community in Temple Oak. Unfortunately, Dukas, the preservation people, they've held us up a bit in trying to preserve a lot of this building, the timber frames and something like that. But we're at the present time going out and tender we've had a FOSS scheme there for some years. The structure is now 100%. We're now going to develop the inside to refurbish the inside of it. But that'll take some time because we've got to preserve the ceilings and
what about,
Templeook House is a major project in the area.
Yes, and were you providing for schools?
Pius School, my local Pius National School, was already developed prior to that, in actual fact. They would have had a small number, suppose the numbers there in those schools in the early days wouldn't have any more than about 100. Now you have probably 400 or 500 in that local national school. And to bring them in by bus and all the rest of it. But no, that's a huge national school, which is only 100 yards away from me. And we have, but the area has developed. We have what we call Rathfarnham Shopping Centre, which is literally part of Temple Oak, Terenure. And that's an excellent supermarket neighbourhood centre. And then we have all the various little neighbourhood centres with small shopping centres. But you're quite right. The area has developed hugely over the last.
Do you find your work a challenge?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed a challenge and the opportunities there for any young person going into politics. There are opportunities there, providing you tell people honestly and fair. I'm a great believer, as I always have done, in dealing with the public with an honesty and an integrity. And people see through you. If you're not honest with people, they see through you. And if you go back in and say, you told us such and such and such and such, people have great memories. But if you're decent and honest with people, they respond.
The other county councillor is with you.
Yeah, that's right. There's seven of us in the
Seven. Board. Who are they?
Well, we have Councillor John Lahart, who is Fianna Fáil. We have Councillor Maura Arda, who's Fianna Fáil. We have Councillor Tony McDermott, who is a Green. We have Councillor Eamon Walsh, who is Labour. We have Councillor Paddy Cosgrave, who's just joined us. And with Councillor Colin Brophy, who is my replacement, who has just been co-opted. We held a co-option meeting going back a couple of months ago, and Councillor Colin Brophy has now joined the council. So I hope that adds up to seven.
It does indeed, yeah. And when you say he's your replacement, you've now retired.
I have. I took retirement on the 24th of December.
Last year.
And so the council were very generous to me. They set up a great send-off party and the county manager and staff with a great
time. Did you get on well together when you were with them together?
Oh yes, I with my fellow colleagues.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you have to really, because I know there's always a certain amount of little political feeling on certain issues. But in order to get anything of real value for your area, you've got to cooperate together, because really it shouldn't be about politics. It should be about what's needed.
Yes.
You know, for the community.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting story, and looking back at all those years, your life working with paint, and you were always a salesman then, weren't you? You were going around.
That's
and
right.
You were selling the paint,
that's
and
right.
Then you were selling yourself.
Absolutely.
As a politician.
Oh, you're quite right. It's all to do with, as I said to you, it's all about to do with. It's just like selling paint. If you have a good product, you've no problem selling it. If I had a good political product in Fine Gael, I had no problem selling them. I'm sure Fianna Fáil would say the same thing. But I had no problem in selling Fine Gael, because I always felt that Liam Cosgrave and the leaders that were there for years, Cosgrave and John Costello and Liam Dillon, James Dillon, and all of them, men of integrity, and I admired them.
What legacy did you leave? What was the one thing that you did when you were elected as councillor here that you can say, well, I did that?
Very difficult, because there were many. Very, very difficult. As I said, I suppose the main thing which I've been involved in really is my this of great ambition that Temple Oak House should be a community facility. I suppose that's the main ongoing project. I've also proposed during my time that we should have an indoor bowling green. We haven't got such a thing an outdoor bowling green. We haven't got such a thing in the county at all. And that is now, we've just started that now around Green Hills. There were, of course, we had great discussion about the provision of a skate rink, for young people, and we provided that in the Lucan area now, and there's demands. It's just been provided in Bushy Park, which is quite close to me, by the Southern City Council. But all in all, I mean, I've been very lucky. I've been involved in many, many issues, and it's the ongoing one, which I'm hoping will, I'll be invited back to the opening of Temple Oak House, hopefully, in the near future.
Well, Stanley Lang, I hope so. And thank you for your story.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me in here this morning. Thank you.